The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to be back after celebrating President's Day, as many of you did as well. Today we're going to talk with Carolyn Miller Parr. She is a retired judge and the author of the book Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. It is a very useful and practical guide to avoid some of the common pitfalls, challenges, and conflicts that can occur during that time. I should mention that she co-wrote the book with Sig Cohen, who's a retired United States Foreign Service officer, fundraiser, and community organizer, now serving as a mediator. The two of them co-authoring Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Parents Age. So she'll be joining us later this hour. We'll also make our way through some of the news that accumulated over the last several days to try to bring us up to date on some of those top headlines. Beginning with Mr. McCabe, he said that the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was absolutely serious about secretly recording the president. The former FBI director said in an interview broadcast on Sunday that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein wasn't joking when he suggested secretly recording President Donald Trump in the Oval Office following that May 2017 dismissal of former FBI Director James Comey. Now, McCabe, speaking on CBS News 60 Minutes, recounted a conversation soon after Comey's firing about the ongoing Russian investigation, in which he said Rosenstein told him, "I never get searched when I go into the White House. I could easily wear a recording device. They wouldn't know it was there," end quote. Now, he was not joking, McCabe said, of the Rosenstein comments. He was absolutely serious, and in fact, he brought it up in the next meeting we had. Well, there's more information being slowly revealed about Mr. McCabe in anticipation of the book. Cory Booker is withholding judgment on the Smollett case after calling it attempted modern-day lynching. Apparently, this Jesse Smollett, after calling the incident a serious threat and linking it to a MAGA symbol, may himself be in a significant amount of trouble. We're going to revisit that in just a few moments, so I won't go into much detail. But Cory Booker and others who came out very quickly in favor of Mr. Smollett and suggesting that this was further evidence of the influence of the president have been very reluctant to backpedal given the current details that have been revealed. Meanwhile, Rush Limbaugh says that the spending bill was an effort by some Republicans to sabotage the president. The conservative radio talk show host, speaking on Fox News Sunday, charged that the compromise spending bill recently signed by the president to avert another partial government shutdown was little more than a disgusting effort by some Republicans to torpedo his 2020 presidential candidacy. The radio host rejected claims that the president is unduly influenced by right-wing media figures and wackos, an accusation that resurfaced amid the ongoing border wall funding dispute. Both parties have people that are still trying to get rid of Donald Trump, Limbaugh said, asserting that Democrats are also working to guarantee a permanent underclass of voters who are uneducated and don't speak English. Meanwhile, Bill de Blasio has corrected the representative Ocasio-Cortez and her claims about spending Amazon tax break money. New York City Mayor de Blasio suggested on Sunday that critics of the potential Amazon campus in New York City, such as the Democratic representative, got the facts wrong over the money behind the tax breaks. The Democratic mayor said, and that $3 billion that would go back in tax incentives was only after we were getting the jobs and getting the revenues. On Sunday morning, de Blasio responded in the affirmative when Chuck Todd of NBC News Meet the Press asked if the tax breaks offered to Amazon weren't money you had over here and it was going over there. Well, think Democrats are for the little guy? Well, think again. Some observers say that amid all the hoopla about Democrats wanting to raise taxes on the rich, they're quietly working on a bill that would increase taxes on every working family in America. So reports Investors Business Daily. Why? To fund expanded benefits from baby boomers hitting retirement. The Social Security 2100 Act would hike the combined payroll taxes paid by workers and their employers from 12.4% today to 14.8% by 2043. The bill would also apply the payroll tax on incomes over $400,000. According to the Social Security Administration, in the first 12 years alone, this would amount to $1.5 trillion tax hike. And the Rhode Island legislature, they're considering a bill to put their state on par with New York by repealing nearly all existing protections for unborn life, report the editors of National Review. It's part of a national campaign by Democrats to use marketing to enshrine a regime of elected abortions through all 9 months of pregnancy. And California Republicans call for a redo vote on high-speed rail projects over the governor's Governor Gavin Newsom's bait and switch on the subject. I would support the citizens of the Central Valley putting this up to a vote again, Shannon Grove, the Republican minority leader of the California State Senate, has said. As I mentioned, actor Jussie Smollett allegedly staged an anti-gay hate crime attack against himself and lied to police, who say it's unconfirmed and inaccurate. But he met with a grand jury earlier today to clarify those issues. And more Facebook facepalm. Facebook maintains a list of individuals that its security guards must be on the lookout for that is comprised of users who've made threatening statements against the company on its social media network, as well as numerous former employees, CNBC reports. Meanwhile, the Washington Post says the Federal Trade Commission and Facebook are negotiating over a multi-billion-dollar fine that would settle the agency's investigation into the social media giant's privacy practices. And once you get beyond the government, the greatest threat to free speech and free thought in America are the social media companies that have been allowed to become monopolies. That's according to an argument made by John Hawkins at Pajama Media. He offers 15 quotes from social media executives and others to make that case. And New York, California, 14 other states have sued President Trump in the Ninth Circuit Court over emergency declaration. The Attorney General of California, New York, Oregon, and 13 other states on Monday filed a lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit against the White House's recent national emergency declaration over border security, claiming the president has veered the country toward a constitutional crisis of its own making. The president had predicted the lawsuit last week. He slammed the Ninth Circuit's multiple times as disgraceful and politically biased. The litigation brought before a federal trial court in the Northern District of California seeks an injunction to prevent the president from shifting billions of dollars from military construction to the border without explicit congressional approval. The suit also asks the court to declare Trump's actions illegal, arguing that the president showed a flagrant disregard of fundamental separation of powers principles ingrained in the U.S. Constitution. It's always interesting to me, depending on whose ox is gored, how important the Constitution becomes. They point out that he's violated the Constitution's presentment and appropriations clauses, which govern federal spending. Rich Lowry points out that I'd have a little more time for all the attacks on the president's emergency declaration on MSNBC if all these same people hadn't eagerly supported every single exercise of executive power on Obama's part, no matter how legally or constitutionally dubious. Again, it's so interesting to see how parties switch up what their priorities are, depending on whether or not they can have the advantage. 15 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
21 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Also coming up in our next segment, we're going to talk with retired Judge Carolyn Miller Parr. She's the co-author of Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. And that can be such a tremendous challenge. We'll talk with her about that shortly. Well, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is expected to step down by mid-March, according to officials. The Deputy Attorney General is expected to leave his role at the department by mid-March, according to a senior Department of Justice official. An official announcement of who has been selected to replace him could come as early as this week. A Trump administration official added that the Attorney General William Barr has picked Jeffrey Rosen, who currently serves as Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation, to take over Rosenstein's place. Talks on him possibly recording the president unfolded over the couple of days, abandoned as too risky, former top FBI lawyers have said. And of course, that's been disputed by Mr. Rosenstein, but has been made quite clear by Mr. McCabe in his latest book that was released today. Well, Venezuelans who escaped socialists, the nightmare that slams the Green New Deal, is backed by Ocasio-Cortez, a former citizen who left the crisis-stricken country in his teens for America, is speaking out against the Maduro regime and giving a warning to anyone who may support the Green New Deal backed by the Democrats, including Representative Ocasio-Cortez. Daniel DiMartino told the story with Martha McCallum that his family went from flourishing in the upper middle class to making just $2 a day under now disputed Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and former President Hugo Chavez. It was an interesting conversation. And a man who died last month at the West Hollywood home of prominent Democratic Party fundraiser Ed Buck warned his friends to steer clear of the well-connected donor and referred to him in rather unflattering words that ended with the word devil and a horrible, horrible man, according to a report Monday night. Timothy Dean, 55, was found dead in the apartment of Mr. Buck early on the 7th of January, 17 months after a 26-year-old male escort was found dead of a methamphetamine overdose at the same location. The Daily Beast reported that Dean and Buck had a relationship years before Moore's death, but Dean's friends claim the relationship turned into a one-sided affair, with Buck sending multiple text messages to Dean and declining to respond. Well, according to Bloomberg, Elizabeth Warren proposed a universal child care plan that would limit American families' expenses to 7% of income, regardless of how many children they have in care, paid for by a tax on the ultra wealthy. The scheme would make child care free for families with incomes below 200% of the poverty level or less than $51,500 for a family of four. The price tag is reportedly $70 billion annually and is estimated to double child care attendance. But as with anything taxpayer funded, this cost is likely woefully underestimated. And according to Gallup, 35% of Americans name the government, poor leadership, or politicians as the greatest problem facing the U.S. This is the highest percentage Gallup has reported for this concern, edging out the previous high of 33% during the 2013 federal government shutdown. Furthermore, the current percentage of Americans naming government as the most important problem is nearly twice as high as the 18% recorded in November. That increase likely reflects public frustration with the government shutdown that occurred from late December through most of January. Not surprisingly, therefore, immigration is number two on the list, with 19% calling it a top problem. Smaller tax refunds put GOP on the defensive, headlines The Hill, which then goes on to report the truth. Smaller refunds means people paid less all year. If only Americans didn't have to wade through disinformation headlines to learn the truth. Representative Matt Gaetz recently revealed that Democrats on the Judiciary Committee voted against notifying ICE when an illegal alien fails a background check to buy a gun. He further observed they hate ICE so much that they'd keep ICE in the dark when illegals try to buy guns and are not eligible. As Town Hall reported last year, a record number of illegal aliens, millions, tried to purchase firearms in the United States. Not only is it illegal to enter the country without permission, it's also illegal to purchase or possess a gun. Ironically, demands for gun control is demonstrably confined to lawful citizens and overlooks those seeking them who are unlawfully in the country. A 45-year-old Mexican national detained by U.S. Customs and Border Protection died on Monday at a medical facility in McAllen, Texas, after twice seeking medical attention. The Washington Post reports, adding that another death is likely to raise fresh questions for the Border Control Organization, especially as the president crusades for a wall at the southern border. The underreported issue is that the unnamed adult was apprehended on February the 2nd for illegal reentry, which means the individual had tried to enter the country at least once before. Also, the individual who had cirrhosis of the liver and congestive heart failure was administered health care twice upon request. WBKO reports a Tennessee man is in jail after being accused of pulling a gun on a Sam's Club customer. But why? Well, according to the alleged victim, a man pulled a gun on him because he was wearing a Make America Great Again hat, a MAGA hat. The police report confirms that this is the suspect, identified as James Phillips, admitted to flipping off Pierce and his wife because of their hats. The mainstream media response, pretty much crickets. And on this day in 2008, an ailing Fidel Castro resigned the Cuban presidency after nearly a half century in power. His brother Raul was later named to succeed him. And on this day in 1986, the U.S. Senate approved 83-11, the Genocide Convention, an international treaty outlawing acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial or religious group, nearly 37 years after the pact was first submitted for ratification. And on this day in 1968, the children's program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, created by and starring Fred Rogers, made its network debut on national educational television, a forerunner to PBS, beginning a 31-season run. And on this day in 1942, during World War II, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which paved the way for the relocation and internment of people of Japanese ancestry, including U.S.-born citizens. And finally, on this day in 1473, astronomer Nicholas Copernicus was born in Turin, Poland. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we are going to talk with the author of Love's Way, I should say co-author, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. If you are a son or a daughter and your parents are still living, there is a season approaching when your parents will age. And this is a very practical guide to avoid and anticipate some of the challenges that families face as parents age. Well, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg returned to the Supreme Court on Friday, concluding a 2-month absence that followed her treatment for lung cancer in December. The Supreme Court's Public Information Office announced that Ginsburg will attend Friday's private conference where the justices make decisions about pending petitions. The announcement was made. The court considered several urgent matters during the conference, including a request from the Trump administration to reverse a court order striking a citizenship question from the 2020 census questionnaire. Given her participation in the Friday conference, she attended an oral arguments today, the first time she had taken the bench since the December procedure. Ginsburg has appeared in public at least once in recent weeks. She attended a production of Notorious RBG in Song. It's a collection of music honoring her professional accomplishments at the National Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C. The justice underwent a procedure called pulmonary lobectomy at the Sloan Kettering Medical Memorial Cancer Center in New York after two cancerous nodules were identified in her lungs. Doctors have since announced that the surgery was successful and there are no remaining signs of the disease. Nevertheless, the justice privately recuperated in the following weeks and missed oral arguments during the court's January sitting. She spoke very decisively with a very strong voice, making it clear that she was back, she was there to stay, and had no intention of retiring anytime soon. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
36 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Did you know that for the first time in U.S. history, older people are projected to outnumber children? And by 2030, 1 in 5 residents will be of retirement age. Meanwhile, the median age, which is 38 now, is expected to increase to 43 in the next 4 decades. What do these impending trends actually mean? Well, former Judge Carolyn Miller Parr and mediator Sig Cohen say the biggest impact are not just demographic or economic, they're practical and emotional, too. Today's seniors, they say, care more about maintaining freedom to make their own decisions. And in their book, Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age, the authors explain how seniors often face loneliness and isolation even from their own children, their adult children. When we were growing up, mom and dad were the permission givers, advisors, financiers, shelter providers, big picture framers, and decision makers, they write. Now children want to advise their parents about safety, finances, and care. Some parents feel relief, but others feel resentment. When an aging parent prefers autonomy to their own safety, this can also create a sense of frustration or fear for their children. Well, Love's Way is a practical handbook. It helps us understand the importance of heartfelt communication, when we avoid the important conversations, it makes matters even worse. It just goes through things that you really need to be prepared to consider, prepare for, and engage in as parents age. Well, my guest, retired Judge Carolyn Miller Parr, is a mediator. She's a writer, public speaker. She's graduated from Stetson University, Vanderbilt, and Georgetown Law. Since 2002, Judge Parr has practiced peacemaking through her mediation practice, Beyond Dispute and Tough Conversations with Sig Cohen, her co-author. The book, once again, is simply titled Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is such an important issue, and as I mentioned, it's going to become more important as time passes. Now, my mother, who is 88, she was widowed many years ago, lives with my husband and me, and I so appreciated so much of what you had to say about the process of families. I have siblings. Making decisions and dealing with how to care for the aging parent. This is a great book for people who anticipate, I want to do a good job, I want to respect my parent or parents, and I want to anticipate some of the challenges. So first of all, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I think you gave a beautiful summary of the book.
Well, you start by saying that the elderly often feel like they're invisible or they're living on the edge. Now, explain what that means. It became obvious to me right away, but explain to our listeners who haven't read your book what that means and why that's the case.
Well, until you become older, you don't imagine that this is true. But if you think about it, when a senior goes to lunch, for example, with an adult child, often the waiter or waitress will speak to the child and say, "What would your mother like to eat?" instead of asking her what she would like to eat. Or they talk baby talk. They talk down to adults sometimes, like, "How are we today?" And you feel like saying, "Well, I don't know how you are today. I'm fine." or "Hi, sweetie," or, you know, this kind of stuff. And it amuses me. I thought the other day about when somebody talked that way to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's 87. Uh-huh. I don't think so. Or they call seniors by their first name without asking their permission, instead of calling them Mrs. And different things like that are signs that you're becoming invisible. Another thing is if, say, a mother has something wrong with her house and she calls a repair person and her son comes over there to just be there and give her a little moral support, almost invariably the repair person will talk to the son as if the mother isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean by invisible. You're just kind of fading away. And it's a creepy feeling, actually.
Well, and you wouldn't anticipate it if you didn't know that that's how it's being interpreted. I think sometimes our actions, we think we're extending respect. Sometimes we are just completely oblivious to how our actions are interpreted by the person to whom they are directed. Now, you write about the difference between independent living and interdependent living. Explain the difference between the two.
Well, independent living implies that you can handle it all yourself. You don't need any help. You're not only in control, but you're better than in control. You're just fine. Interdependent living is actually what most of us are living, but we don't think about it that way. That's when we recognize that we do need other people, that we're part of a community, and that we can't function totally alone. So we're trying to give service to other people, to help other people in need, and we also need to learn, as we age, to accept other people's help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so we move from this idea of thinking independent living to realizing that we're part of a family, part of a larger group, and we need each other.
And I think that's when it becomes really important that we acknowledge the value and the capacity of individuals to manage at least most of their affairs, or a good number of them, and to treat them with respect as we would have when our parents were much younger.
Exactly. And oftentimes the children think they know better than the parents. This is part of this role reversal mm-hmm. that happens gradually over time. At first it's pretty painless. It's things like mom and dad are not as good on the computer as their children are, so they might call and ask for some advice about how to solve a little glitch that's come up or that kind of thing. But they're still maybe advising the children about law, in my case, for example, or taxes or something that the parent has some expertise in, and the child accepts that. And you've moved from a parent-child kind of relationship to a equal relationship, to adults working together with each other. But then gradually the parent can't do as much as they used to, and maybe mom, who's always been the hostess at the family dinners for Thanksgiving and Christmas and all, says, how about if I just bring a dish this time and you have it at your house? And the child will say fine, and that's pretty painless to everybody. But gradually those things happen more and more. As a parent gets to where they can't climb a ladder, or they maybe they shouldn't be driving at night. They want some help being taken someplace if they feel bad or something. So, and especially once they're widowed, one of them loses a spouse, mm-hmm. They tend to need their children more and more. The problem happens when the children move in and become like helicopter parents. You hear about that? Yes. There are helicopter children, too, that are just hovering over the parent. Or they come in and they say, gee, mom, it's time for you to downsize. Let me help you get rid of this and this and this and this. And, you know, the parent sort of starts pushing back a little bit. Say, back off. I'm not dead yet. So one of the things that we say is, even if you think you know best, even if you think you know what kind of care your mother should have or what kind of doctor she should go to or whatever, go ahead and suggest it. And she ought to listen to see what you have to say. But unless she's incapacitated in some way, she really has to make the final decision.
Yes.
The mother and father still need their decision needs to be respected, and they even have the right to make a mistake.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that's been one of the challenges for my husband and me. When my mother's physical capacities diminish, not to assume that that means she's incapable of everything and start taking over. Sometimes I have a different opinion, but I'm very careful to allow her to be who she is, an adult, and make decisions for herself. And there may be a point in the future when that's no longer possible, but it's a challenge to be respectful and to acknowledge that she has not only taken care of herself, but she raised me, and to be respectful of her capacity to think for herself.
You know, it is. I had my two parents living with me at one point, and my mother had Alzheimer's, and my father was taking care of her in my house. We had an apartment in the basement for them. But it got to where he couldn't do it anymore, and I was working full time, and so she did need to go to an assisted living. But it was a blessing to have them with me. And especially to have, it was harder with mom, but to have my father with me was such a blessing. You know, in the U.S., we don't do that often.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting less and less often as children are more scattered. You know, I have a sister in California, one in Florida, and I live in the D.C. area. So the family caregiving patterns have changed a lot. I have some friends from Latin America, though, who, when I told them I was inviting my parents to come and live with me, they said, oh, are you sure you want to do that? Oh, my goodness. No, the ones from Latin America didn't say that. The Americans said that.
Yeah.
The ones from Latin America said, oh, I'm so jealous. I wish I had my parents live with me. What a blessing you have. And it was interesting to see the difference in the cultures.
Yeah. Now we need to take a quick break. We have a commercial break coming up, but we'll continue our conversation. Again, we're talking about the book Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. I'm continuing my conversation with Carolyn Miller Parr, who, along with her co-author Sig Cohen, wrote the book Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. And it is a challenge and certainly will become more of a challenge as the demographic continues to change. You write a lot about our assumptions that reinforce misunderstanding and lead to conflict. What are some of the dangerous assumptions that we tend to make that we can avoid if we think this through with the help of Love's Way?
Yeah, well, part of them, one of them is mind reading. We think we know what the other person thinks, or we believe they know what we think, and we expect them to guess at what we want mm-hmm. or what we think. One is fortune telling. We know what's going to happen if this or that or the other. One is just not knowing anything about the context in which somebody else is doing something. This comes up a lot with siblings. We saw a lot of sibling rivalry in our mediations around the parents aging. You know, the children have disagreements about where mom should live or who should take her in or who should live with her or where she should be if she goes to assisted living or how it's going to get financed or who should have her power of attorney, who should be in charge of her will. I'm saying her a lot of times, mm-hmm. with them too, but those kinds of things sometimes really bring up old hidden wounds between siblings. So many of them are based on wrong assumptions about what someone else is doing. For example, one child, say a sister who's unemployed, moves in with mom to help her. The other kids can start to get really jealous of that relationship, and they may suspect that she's freeloading, for example, or she's taking advantage of mom in some way without looking to see what it is they know and what it is they don't know, and they're just assuming. For example, they may not know if she's looking for a job. They may not know if mom invited her to come in and wants her there. They may not know exactly what she's doing for mom. They may not know if she's paying rent. They may not know how much it would cost to have somebody else come in and do what the sister's doing. So those are assumptions, and it's really good to question your own assumptions when you are angry about somebody or you think something's going on. One way to do that is to make a list of what I know, and that in this case would be, I know my sister has moved in with my mother, and I know my sister's not working. Then you make a list of what I don't know. Mm-hmm. What I know I don't know. I don't know if she's got a job. I don't know if she's looking. You know, I don't know this. I don't know that. And then you make a list of what you think you know, but you may not really know. And that would be all those questions I just said. And once you look at that, you think, well, there could be a lot of answers to this, not just the one I jumped to. That's a way to help us get along with people, because yeah. otherwise we just make oftentimes the wrong conclusion and we attribute something negative to somebody that they don't deserve to have attributed.
Yeah, and I suppose that can be rooted in family history as much as current circumstance. You say it's important to include all your adult children in the care. Is that to minimize misunderstanding and to perhaps mitigate conflict that might arise if someone is left out of that care?
Yeah. A lot of times the kids are not all living around mm-hmm. mom or dad. So the ones who are step in and get most of the responsibility, or there may only be one child in the family. But if there are more than one child, it's important that they all find a way to contribute. If they maybe call once a week if they live far away, or if they come and take mom and dad on a vacation once a year and give a break to the one who's the caregiver at home. Or maybe one of them could take over paying mom's bills, and another one could take her to the doctor's appointment, so that everybody can feel like they're contributing in some way and that they're still important in their parent's life, and the parent knows that each of them cares for her or him.
Now, as believers are thinking about how to navigate this sometimes challenging waters, What does the Bible say about end-of-life issues and the aged?
Well, you know, the most obvious one that jumps out is Exodus 20:12. Let honor your father and mother that your days may be long on the land which the Lord your God gives you. And Proverbs 23:22 says, hearken to your father who begot you and do not despise your mother when she is old. And then the New Testament has words about it too. James 1:27 says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction. But I think one of the most vivid ones is when Jesus was on the cross dying, and his one of his very last thoughts was for his mother. And he asked John to take her home with him, and John did. She became John's mother. And to me, that's the primary example that Christians have.
Oh, I love that. I hadn't thought of it in that in this context. Now, you say that every adult, regardless of age, needs three legal documents. What are these documents so that we're careful that everything is in order?
Well, everybody needs a will. Some people also have a trust, but you got to have a will, because even think money comes in after you're dead that you don't even expect to have come in, the last paycheck. Or my father, $9,000 came in on my father after he died that he didn't know was going to happen because of lawsuits that were going on for things he had been a part of, and he didn't even know about it. So you need a will, but you also need powers of attorney, one for financial matters and one for your health care. And that's because there may come a time when you cannot make those decisions for yourself. None of us wants to think about that, but Alzheimer's is now so prevalent for people over 85. I think about 50% of people have it now. Or some other kind of dementia. And not only that, but you can have a stroke, you could have a head injury, you could fall and be hurt and just not be able to talk or not be able to think clearly about what you needed. So it's very important that even younger people have powers of attorney. You give it to someone you really trust who is good with finances, maybe your financial power of attorney. For someone who lives near you and can take you to the doctor, maybe for your health care power of attorney. Doesn't have to be a child. It could be a neighbor, a good friend, even a pastor if he's willing to take that on. But it has to be somebody you trust because they have tremendous power. A lot of people, though, don't know that they can change their power of attorney and that they still keep control themselves. So let's say you give a child a power of attorney, but you see something you want to do. Well, you can go ahead and do it. You don't have to wait for the child to do it. And you could even make out the power of attorney, sign it, have it witnessed, and keep it yourself until you thought they needed it.
Yeah, you don't forfeit your capacity to make your own decisions. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and if you can, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions on the other side of the break.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. News and traffic up next.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show. James Blind is producing. Clark Hilton is engineering today's program. I'm continuing a conversation I began in the previous hour with retired Judge Carolyn Miller Parr. She is a mediator along with Sig Cohen, who is her co-author. They say the biggest impacts on the aging population isn't just demographic or economic, it's practical and emotional. And in fact, for the first time in the United States history, older people are projected to outnumber children. And by 2030, 1 in 5 residents will be of retirement age. Well, you can imagine the implications of all of that. The book we're talking about is Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. It's titled Love's Way. And we're just finishing a conversation we began in the previous hour. If you missed the early part of that conversation, you can go to kpdq.com, check out our podcast, and you can hear it in its entirety. And I just wanted to ask you a few more things before we end our conversation. What are the hopes and concerns that you've heard older adults express about their future? Because when you're younger, it's difficult to imagine. One of the things your book helps us do is to take the guesswork out and to challenge us to kind of think through some of the things that we're going to be confronted with. What are some of these hopes and concerns that you've heard?
Well, I think they don't want to burden their children. So they worry a little bit about how they're going to avoid that. They want to have enough money to be able to take care of themselves and in any needs that they're going to have. Think they want to be as pain-free as possible. They want loved ones to be close. They want to know they're loved and forgiven by God and by their family. We've all done things that we wish we hadn't done with our family, with our parents, and with our children. And so it's important to think about those and apologize to them if it's appropriate and ask for forgiveness. And I think older people hope to be remembered and remembered in a good way. They also might want to die at home rather than in a hospital or a nursing home. And so they need to express that to their children, though, or the kids won't know it. And, of course, some Christians express hope of being reunited with others who have gone before.
One of the things I appreciate about Love's Way is you help us to anticipate what in many cases is inevitable, that we know that at some point we're going to lose our parents. How do we think through approaching that new stage in life as respectful adult children, as siblings, and so on, so that we can make that season of their life as smooth as possible? You refer to emergencies as the greatest precursor of crisis. Now, explain what you mean by that and how we might anticipate the possibility of emergencies, and I think your book helps us do that as well.
Well, thanks. One of the things is that parents really need a plan B. Plan A is what you're doing now, and it's working fine. You're living independently or whatever. Plan B is what do you do when things go wrong? If you fall and break a hip, what then? And if you don't have a plan, you're going to have a crisis because, let's say you fall and break a hip. You're in the hospital, and then you have maybe 30 days in a recovery place, and then you've got to go someplace. You've got to live someplace where you can get care, where you can get around, where you can get well. And is that going to work where you've been living? Do you have stairs where you've been living? So it's just really important to have a plan B and to talk about it with your kids or certainly with spouses. What happens when this doesn't work anymore? And people put off doing that because they don't want to think about what they're doing now not working anymore. But we're all going to face that. And so it's very important to do it. It's also really important to have conversations with your children about these things. And that's so hard, or with your parents, depending on what generation you're in. Children don't like to bring it up because it's sensitive. They don't want their parents to think they're not okay, and they don't want their parents to think they're greedy or they're looking forward to them being helpless or being sick or whatever. The parents don't like to bring it up because they think they're going to burden their children or they're going to scare their children. And they also don't want to face their own decline. So one of the things we do talk about in the book is how to let go, because old age is a process of letting go. You're letting go of your physical abilities. You're letting go of your hearing. You have to get glasses or have cataract surgery. And then you are not that spry about getting up and down the stairs or whatever. And gradually you let go of a spouse, or you let go of friends, you see them die. And so it can be a hard time. And children are very important in this, going both ways. For the children, it's important that they accompany their parents and that they're with them in that time. And for the parents, it's important that their children be a resource for them and be willing and want to help them as much as they can. So all of that declining period is major spiritual and emotional work for adults of both ages.
Now, you encourage your readers to prepare to say four things to a loved one at the end. What are these four things, and why do you think it's important for us to express them at that stage of life, at the end of life?
Well, it's actually important to express them all through your life. but when people are dying, they really want to hear that they're loved and forgiven. And so Dr. Ira Byock, who is a hospital and palliative care specialist, the doctor, a hospice specialist, says that he's heard people say, "Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you." And he wrote a book called The Four Things That Matter Most, and those are the things that he said. But it struck me when I read it that, yes, I would like to hear those four things on my deathbed and be able to say, "Please forgive me," as well as to say, "I forgive you." But also, why wait till you're dying?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly if you haven't said them yet, that's the right time to do it. But you're right, it should be a part of our regular communication. Well, the book, once again, is titled Love's Way, Living Peacefully with Your Family as Your Parents Age. It's a very practical book, and I would say it's great for those whose parents are aging and those who are in the aging process as well, to help us all be realistic about the course that life takes and to prepare for it in a way that maintains dignity and you're prepared for whatever may come. And we can't predict that, but we do know that certain things are certain for all of us. Thank you so much for your time today and for the book, Love's Way.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. By the way, the book is published by Hendrickson, is available in bookstores. Being a primary caregiver, this was very helpful to me, and it might be helpful to you as well. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
20 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Well, President Trump said on Friday and followed through with it, he was declaring a national emergency of the southern border, tapping into executive powers in a bid to divert billions toward construction of a wall, even as he signs a funding package that includes just $1.4 billion for border security. "We're going to confront the national security crisis on our southern border," he said, "one way or the other. We have to do it." He was speaking from the Rose Garden. Well, the move was expected to and did face a swift and forceful legal challenge that could stall the attempt in the courts for the near future. But the declaration and other money-moving plans allow the president to continue to fight for border wall construction while also averting another partial government shutdown, which, of course, they did last week. Well, the Attorney General of California, New York, Oregon, and 13 other states on Monday, as expected, filed a suit in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals against the White House. That also expected the Ninth Circuit. In the recent national emergency declaration over border security that claims the president has veered the country toward a constitutional crisis of its own. The president sarcastically predicted the lawsuit last week. He slammed the Ninth Circuit multiple times for being disgraceful and politically bias. It is the most often overturned of the district courts. But nonetheless, the litigation brought before a federal trial court in the Northern District of California seeks an injunction that would prevent the president from shifting billions of dollars from military construction to the border without explicit congressional approval. Now, there's a specific process, a protocol for this kind of an emergency declaration, and it does require eventually for Congress to be informed on the specifics of the authority that the president is claiming and the resources that are being called upon. So this is part of the required process. The suit is not, but that kind of explicit detail. The suit also asked the court to declare Trump's actions illegal, arguing that the president showed a flagrant disregard of fundamental separation of powers principles ingrained in the United States Constitution by violating the Constitution's presentment and appropriate clauses which govern federal spending. Now, there is an authority given to the president to declare a national emergency. So that's a bit of an overstatement. However, there is oversight granted to Congress. Now, we'll see if the Ninth Circuit oversteps its bounds in saying the president has no authority, rather than that the president is required to do X, Y, and Z in order for that authority to be exercised. So we'll see how this will move forward. Well, the attorneys general specifically argue that the border wall does not require use of the armed forces as mandated under 10 U.S.C. Section 2808, the federal law which governs construction projects during national emergencies. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan, he reportedly said this week that he isn't sure there is a military necessity at the border or how much the agency would need to spend. Well, the states contend, and again, including Oregon, that they have standing to sue the administration, and it seems to me they probably do have standing to file suit, largely because they allege the federal funds could have been spent on their defense. Maine is aggrieved by the actions of defendants and has standing to bring this action in particular because of the injury to the state and its residents caused by defendants' reduction of federal defense spending in Maine due to diversion of funding to the border wall, one section of the suit reads. Well, again, I think it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that Maine is now going to be under-defended by the U.S. military. But nonetheless, when you're grasping at straws, either by extending a state of emergency or by challenging one, these are the kinds of things you're likely to see. California is aggrieved by the actions of defendants and has standing to bring this action because of the injury due to the loss of federal drug interdiction, counter-narcotic, law enforcement funding to the state caused by defendants' diversion of funding. Now, they're referring to specific funding, and I have not read the declaration of emergency to see if the president explicitly calls upon those funds to be diverted for this purpose, but that's what the court will be evaluating. Are they referring to what they think might happen or what the declaration of emergency says explicitly this money is intended to be drawn from? In addition to Maine, California, and New York, the group of states includes Delaware, Oregon, Hawaii, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Virginia, Nevada, New Jersey, and New Mexico. Declaring a national emergency when one does not exist is immoral and illegal. That's from New York Attorney General Letitia James. Now, it's interesting, under the Obama administration, we were told there was a crisis at the border. Under the Trump administration, we're being told there's a crisis at the border. Again, it's frustrating because the inconsistency across political lines is staggering, but I digress. In a separate statement, California Governor Gavin Newsom, he remarked that President Trump is manufacturing a crisis and declaring a made-up national emergency in order to seize power and undermine the Constitution. Again, we'll see what the Ninth Circuit Court ultimately does. I think no one believes that it will be settled there. It will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And that will take some time. What will happen between now and then is that the president will be prevented from moving forward. And we'll just have to see what the timeline will be and ultimately what the final decision will be. Well, not surprisingly, the president has predicted the Supreme Court will ultimately vindicate his declaration of a national emergency. Now, that may take months. It may take years. I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, he predicted, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, the president said in the Rose Garden. This is on Friday, when it was announced he intended to declare a national emergency. In her weekly press conference on Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said what's happening at the border is not a crisis and warned that the Trump administration could be marking an executive overreach that a future Democratic president could use as a precedent. Well, the previous Democratic president was significant in executive overreach, so it doesn't begin here. It continues here. Again, politicians, it's very frustrating. Well, most Republicans seem to be backing the president, but several are critical. Senator Rand Paul criticized both the legislation and what he called the extra constitutional executive action. Senator Marco Rubio, he also tweeted that no crisis justifies violating the Constitution, not suggesting there isn't a crisis, but that this does not justify the action that the president has taken. At least these two have been consistent. They were critical of the previous administration and are under the current. Congress failed to adequately address the border crisis that has reached a crescendo with the recent migrant caravans, but the president's declaration carries significant downside. That's a quote from The Heritage Foundation President Kay Cole James, in a statement, she points out that for 2 years, Congress denied the president the necessary resources to secure the border for political reasons. That standoff sadly ended in the nation's longest ever government shutdown. Frustrated with Washington, the president believes he has no choice but to take this action today. While it is strictly constitutional, it carries significant downside. This creates a dangerous precedent for future administrations and exposes the critical need for border security to the whims of activist federal judges. Presidents have statutory authority with congressional. That's the end of her quote, by the way. Well, presidents do have statutory authority with congressional checks and balances to declare a national emergency. However, typically, presidents declare these in the case of a natural disaster, terrorist attack, or war. This one will likely face a legal challenge as it comes in the backdrop of a policy debate. So the back and forth will continue. As I mentioned, the Ninth Circuit will not be the last word. My guess is it will end up in several courts, ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, and whether or not the clock will run out before the president's first term has ended, that remains a possibility. We'll see what the court finally has to say about it. You'll recall some of the issues under the previous administration were not resolved until the current administration, so this could go on for quite some time. Meanwhile, rising Democratic star Beto O'Rourke of Texas said Thursday that not only does he oppose the president's border wall, but he would rip out existing walls along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, Mr. O'Rourke had been publicly asked by freshman Representative Dan Crenshaw, a Texas Republican, that if border walls are immoral or dangerous, why let the existing ones stand? Well, MSNBC host Chris Hayes repeated the question to him on Thursday. Yes, absolutely, he said. I'd take the wall down, said the former U.S. representative from El Paso, Texas, who's widely seen as a possible 2020 presidential hopeful and a very large group of presidential hopefuls. Mr. O'Rourke also said El Paso residents now benefiting from some of those wall segments would back his stance if a referendum on whether to tear it down were to be presented. The ex-congressman who lost a U.S. Senate bid to incumbent Republican Ted Cruz in November said the fencing that already had been built had killed more than 4,000 illegal immigrants. It's not clear at all what he's referring to. It has pushed migrants and asylum seekers and refugees to the most inhospitable, most hostile stretches of the U.S.-Mexico border, ensuring their suffering and death. More than 4,000 human beings, little kids, women, and children have died. So he's suggesting that the wall forces them to try to break the law in other locations that are more dangerous, and therefore the existing walls are responsible for their deaths. It's a bit of a strained logic, but nonetheless, that was his public statement. 31 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
At the clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Well, Senator Bernie Sanders announced on Tuesday that he will make another bid for president by entering the already crowded 2020 race as he tries to rekindle the grassroots energy from his 2016 primary run against Hillary Clinton. Now, things are quite different now than they were then, especially when you consider others who are running who are either to the left of him or at least as close to him as a Democrat running could have been. Sanders made the announcement in an interview with Vermont Public Radio, followed by a web video and email to supporters. Together, you and I and our 2016 campaign began the political revolution. Now it's time to complete that revolution and implement the vision that we fought for, he told supporters. While blasting President Trump as a pathological liar, he said in the radio interview he's running to pursue policies like universal health care and a $15 minimum wage. He challenged this time, however, or rather his challenge will be standing out in a field of candidates who largely have adopted the big government policies he championed 3 years ago. The Republican National Committee cited his influence on the field's present-day policies in blasting his announcement, saying Bernie Sanders is a self-avowed socialist who wants to double your taxes so the government can take over your health care. The vast majority of voters oppose his radical agenda, they wrote, just like they are going to oppose all the 2020 Democrats who have rushed to embrace it. That's a quote from the Republican National Committee spokesman, Michael Ahrens. Well, Sanders, a progressive populist socialist who identifies as a Democratic socialist, put up a serious fight against Democratic contender, Hillary Clinton, in the 2016 primary. He joins a field already that consists of top Democratic senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, and two of the most progressive lawmakers in the Senate. Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Jeff Merkley of Oregon are also seriously considering presidential bids. Merkley was the only senator to endorse Sanders in 2016. Another progressive, Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, who also backed Sanders' first White House bid, is also in that race. Sanders is 77. He's had to deal with recent months with a sexual harassment and mistreatment controversy stemming from his 2016 campaign staff, which elicited apologies from the senator. And he will be the oldest sitting president if he were to be elected in 2020. Let's see, 77 now. He'd be, what, 79, I think, at the time, if he were to be elected. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, announced a plan that would fund universal child care by tapping into revenue from her wealth tax proposal. The broad strokes of the plan, which would cover 12 million children, would mean no family would have to spend more than 7% of its total household income, according to the Huffington Post, which first reported on the announcement. The report said the number is based off a Department of Health and Human Services figure on what qualifies as affordable child care. Well, the plan is still being worked on, but sources told the news outlet that they expect it to cost about $700 billion, that's with a B, in new funding over 10 years. And that's four times what the federal government pays on these programs. The Wall Street Journal reported that the average family pays $7,200 a year on child care. The Massachusetts Democrat, a 2020 presidential candidate, would use part of the revenue from her proposed taxes on the ultra wealthy to fund the plan. Her plan calls for a 2% tax on household wealth above $50 million and an additional 1% on those above $1 billion. Now, it's interesting because millionaires and billionaires are expected to cover a lot of the proposals that are being made. That is not a spigot that doesn't ultimately run dry. And whether or not that in the calculation of those who support the plan will trickle down to the average American remains to be seen. But a $70 billion per year plan for universal child care will be, according to Elizabeth Warren, will be once again tapping the wealthy. Well, right now, the Democratic presidential field includes 9 declared candidates, a few more pondering the possibility. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, Maryland Representative John Delaney, Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, California Senator Kamala Harris, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. You had Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and others who are considering, including an Oregon representative. In the coming weeks and months, the field may grow to include former Vice President Joe Biden, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, former Attorney General Eric Holder, Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton, former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke. Ohio Representative Tim Ryan, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who announced today. Well, that would be another 11, and there may be other even lesser known figures in the party contemplating the campaign. Well, today, the Democratic National Committee set out the rules for participation in the first two primary debates, which will be held in June and July. The party expects to hold each debate over 2 nights, splitting the candidates into 2 groups. No earlier in the evening undercard debate like the Republicans had in 2016. So this is a better plan from my perspective when you're trying to sort through all of the candidates. To qualify for the debate, a presidential candidate must reach 1% in 3 separate polls of either the national or one of the early nominating states of Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, or Nevada. And even if a candidate can't reach that low polling threshold, they can still qualify by having 65,000 donors with at least 200 donors in 20 states. They set out a system of tiebreakers if more than 20 candidates meet this criterion. Well, there aren't many good options when you have 20 or so candidates, but Democrats have put together a formula for chaos, assuming even, I'm sure they've learned from the Republicans from last time around, assuming each night has 10 candidates, a two-hour debate will leave each candidate with 12 minutes, and that's not accounting for time for introductions, questions, audience response, such as laughter, applause, or rebuttals, candidates' inability to resist the temptation to go for slogans or hackneyed applause lines is one reason debate organizers should contemplate not having an audience. Just an aside. If you limit each candidate to 3 minutes to answer a question, one quarter of the debate will pass before you move on to the second question. So this is a big challenge for the Dems this time around, and it certainly was for the Republicans last time around. There is an option to give candidates more time, which is to let the debate go longer rather than 2 hours, maybe running for 3 hours. The September 16th, 2015 Republican presidential primary debate ran more than 3 hours. Right now, each debate would be at least 4 hours spread over two nights. By July, we'll have eight hours of them debating each other. If the debates are 3 hours long by July, we'll have 12 hours of debate, and so on. You can kind of do the math. Debates very much suffer from the tragedy of the commons. What's best for each individual candidate is not best for the group or as a whole. Candidates will desperately want to be memorable, YouTube moments, and they'll know one of the ways to generate one is through confrontation or interrupting another candidate's answers and so on. Putting 10 people on a stage only increases the pressure to stand out from the sizable crowd. And that is the challenge that the Democrats will very likely face in the months ahead as they're trying to give each of these candidates an opportunity to distinguish him or herself from others and try to garner the support of would-be Democratic voters. So something interesting to consider in the days ahead. Let's see, I have one more thing I was going to mention. I can't think of what. Here it is. One other thing. The president has announced today that he is formally directing the Department of Defense to draft legislation creating a so-called Space Force within the United States Air Force in a bid to launch the first new branch of the military in more than 70 years. Now, this is a new branch, but it is within the Air Force. Officially known as the Space Policy Directive 4, the directive would put Trump's Space Force on similar grounds as the U.S. Marine Corps, which is part of the Navy, but stipulates that it could become its own separate department in the future. Now, cost details are expected to be included in the 2020 budget proposal the president sends Congress next month. The directive was developed by the National Space Council alongside members of the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Office of the Director of National Intelligence, National Security Council, Office of Management and Budget, and the White House Counsel's Office. Space Force will also be represented on the Joint Chiefs of Staff and overseen by an Air Force Undersecretary for Space. So we'll get a budget in about a month, and we'll see the details as they unfold in the days ahead. Space Force. I wonder what kind of uniforms they'll have. What kind of helmet or hat or something to think about. 46 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. I hope you enjoyed a great President's Day. It's good to be back in studio and to let you know what's coming up the remainder of this week. On Wednesday, I'm looking forward to hosting India Partners. They're going to hold their annual radiothon. Now, some of you might recall back in October, November, I had the opportunity to travel with India Partners to the ministries that you've heard us talk about here on KPDQ. And I wasn't surprised because I know about India Partners and the work that they do, but I was so delighted to see firsthand, to meet the people who are engaged in the ministry that we've talked about, to see the progress that's been made because of your generosity. I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to talk a little bit more about that when India Partners spends the day here at KPDQ talking about their work and opportunities we have to make a difference. So that's coming up on Wednesday. Thursday, you'll hear the best of the Georgine Rice Show. I have some things that are going to call me away from the station. And then on Friday, I'm looking forward to a fun Friday program. We've been collecting quite a few things that are on the lighter side of the news and want to take the opportunity to share some of them with you on Friday. Do also want to extend a personal invitation to join me and other women from our community at Ignite 2019. This is the conference that's sponsored by Western Seminary and their women's program there. You and I are in the midst of a very busy, stressful season in life. The world is just that way, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed with life and to lose the wonder of our unfailing God. So this year, Ignite the Wonder is the theme. It's a one-day conference for women, and we are encouraging you to come enjoy speakers, meaningful worship, prayer, dynamic breakout sessions. That's coming up on Saturday, March the 3rd at Greater Portland Bible Church. Actually, I think Saturday is the 2nd. I'll have to check on that. Anyway, Saturday, the first Saturday in March at Greater Portland Bible Church on Vermont Street in Portland. It is the 2nd. Yeah, it is March the 2nd. Plus, I have the opportunity to speak on the wonder of God's love and how we can extend it to others. And there's a wonderful panel of women that will be joining me to make that presentation to challenge all of us to think about what God is calling us to in the normal course of life in extending the love of Christ in nurturing and growing our capacity for compassion and really making a difference. It's possible if you are a mom raising very small children. It's possible if you are a retiree. It's possible if you struggle with a disability. It's possible under every circumstance to extend the love of Christ in a way that's meaningful. I have a friend who is now confined to a care facility. She had been confined to a wheelchair for quite some time. She's no longer able to navigate as she once did in that wheelchair. But she has one of the most significant ministries of women I know, and she does it from the room that she lives her life in. And whenever she sends out an email or talks about some aspect of her life and God's provision for her, I am inspired and encouraged and just delighted. So it's possible for every one of us. And we're going to be talking about how the wonder of God's love gives us the capacity to extend that love to others. Now, online registration is open. You can find out more and get your tickets at kpdq.com or the KPDQ mobile app. Let me encourage you to do that. You have a discounted price right up until the 23rd, so make note of that. Come by yourself, come with a group of friends, just come. We want to encourage you to do that, and I promise you that you will feel at home once you're there. Again, that's coming up Saturday, March the 2nd at Greater Portland Bible Church on Southwest Vermont Street in Portland. Well, I found this a little bit encouraging. A teenager has built a working nuclear fusion reactor in his home in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, two things come to mind. The first is, hey, this is pretty impressive for a teenager. The second one is, I'm glad he lives in Memphis and not somewhere close by in Portland. Some kids spend their time on social media. Other kids spend their time playing video games. When it comes to 14-year-old Jackson Oswalt, who looks more like he's about 12, his time is spent in a laboratory working on a nuclear fusion reactor. Well, this Memphis teenager, he finished his reactor and achieved fusion at the age of 13. He's regarded by experts as the youngest in America, maybe even the world, to accomplish it. Jackson built a steel machine made of vacuums, pumps, chambers that's capable of smashing atoms together through force in the smoking hot plasms center that releases a burst of fusion energy. Now, I had a hard time even saying it. The kid's actually done it. If you've ever wondered how the sun and other stars are powered, the process within his nuclear fusion reactor is comparable. He started working on this thing at age 12 after concluding that he didn't want to dedicate his leisure time to solely playing video games like, oh, Fortnite. He started scouring the internet for nuclear-related things because that's what he says held his interest. Yes, he was 12 years old and that held his interest. Well, during his research, Jackson came across Taylor Wilson, who in 2008, at 14 years old, garnered international recognition as the youngest person to achieve fusion by building a nuclear reactor in his parents' garage. And that was in Texarkana, Arkansas. Well, Jackson, like any 12-year-old, thought that he could at least try to beat the record set by Wilson. From there, he got to work. Well, to start the process was just learning about what other people had done with the fusion reactors, explain the mild-mannered teenager. After that, he assembled a list of parts he needed. He got those parts off of eBay primarily. And then oftentimes the parts that he managed to scrounge on eBay weren't exactly what he needed, so he'd have to modify them to be able to use them in the way that he needed. Well, building that reactor fusion, or I should say nuclear fusion reactor, was no game for him. He converted an old playroom in his Memphis home into a functioning lab. With the financial support of his parents, he spent between $8,000 to $10,000 over the course of a year collecting the parts to build his nuclear fusion reactor. That was apparently the easy part. Of course, assembling it was another matter. Putting the fusion reactor together and testing it, you get the idea. Well, after a while, it became pretty simple to realize how it all worked together, he says. But at that at the start, it was definitely difficult figuring out one aspect of the whole thing, memorizing what that actually meant, and then moving on to a different aspect. Well, Jackson's father had no real understanding of what his son was working on, nuclear reactor in the playroom. Outside of his safety concern, the father said that he was astonished at what his son was attempting to do. Being a parent of someone that was that driven and only 12 years old was really impressive to see. Well, throughout the process, Jackson posted his results on the Open Source Fusion Research Consortium up until the point when he was able to achieve fusion on the 19th of January, 2018. That's hours before his 13th birthday. Hence, the youngest to have accomplished such a feat. In Jackson's case, that meant combining two atoms with gas in the fusion reactor's plasma's core. See, I'm struggling saying it. The kid did it. Which ejected a neutron into a device that slowed it down and detected nuclear fusion. 12 years old. Pretty impressive. Teen builds working nuclear fusion reactor in Memphis home. Maybe there is hope for the future for some of these young people. Absolutely there is. All right. I want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Hope you'll join us here tomorrow for our India Partners Radiothon. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at G Rice Show and like us on Facebook and join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.